We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who share how meditation and mindfulness practices change our lives. Our podcast is brought to you by Meditation Studio, Apple's pick as one of the 10 best apps of the year. Why download the app? Because life is messy. We get stressed, anxious, have trouble sleeping. We work too hard, deal with conflict. Our hearts get broken. We worry about the state of the world. We meditate because we're human. Our app gives you hundreds of meditations from over 30 leading experts. It helps a lot. And you can now enjoy 8 free meditations on Alexa. And don't forget to check out our Meditation Studio daily Facebook group where we're getting together to share our meditation experiences. Just go to Meditation Studio app on Facebook and join there. Today's guest is Lynn McTaggart, award-winning journalist, investigative reporter, and international best-selling author who has studied the power of group intention and its impact on healing. Her recent book, The Power of 8, highlights a number of intention experiments that she has done with small groups. I have to say, this interview was a little bit outside of my comfort zone, and I am a bit of a skeptic, but Lynn also shares the science behind some pretty miraculous results, and she shares how she overcame her own skepticism. It felt a little woo-woo at first, be warned, but she's got so many success stories, it really makes you rethink how we can connect with others to impact some really big changes. This might really be about the power of connection, community, and of being of service to others. I'm curious to hear what you think. Now, here's Lynn. Lynn McTaggart, thank you so much for being on Untangle today.
It's my thrill to be with you.
Yeah. So, wow, you have done so much really interesting work in your life. I would love to know how you originally began your meditation practice and how did you get into this work to begin with?
Well, I mean, I did meditation in the 1970s. So when TM first came out, I was interested in that, but I've always had a real interest in evidence, hard evidence. And that has a lot to do with the fact that I started out life as a hard-nosed investigative reporter. I mean, my work in my 20s was all about cracking baby selling rings and having hidden tape recorders and things like that. So I was used to that kind of fact gathering, and that probably has never left me. But I began segueing into this subject kind of by accident. I mean, I got ill in the mid 80s and I couldn't find out what was wrong with me. It's very simple. Faulty microbiome is what they would call it now, but it caused a collection of symptoms people didn't recognize back then. And so that healing journey led me to found What Doctors Don't Tell You, and a newsletter, but now an international magazine that provides information about what works and what doesn't work in conventional and alternative medicine. And in the course of doing that work, which requires that we look at the medical literature all the time and look at the various studies, I kept coming across really good studies of things like spiritual healing. And that just set me off thinking, if we can have a thought and send it to someone else and make that person better, that completely undermines what we think of how the world works. And so I persuaded my publishers back in the late 90s to let me go on a journey, basically without a compass, and that was to find whether or not there are human energy fields. And what I found instead was a number of scientists involved in consciousness research who were coming up with extraordinary discoveries, which together compound to a completely new view of the world. And so I published that, the field, but there was a little nagging thing in me that kept thinking about some of the discoveries, which suggested that thoughts are an actual something with the capacity to change physical matter. And the journalist in me kept asking inconvenient questions. There was plenty of evidence about this, and of course it was the time of a lot of talk about the law of attraction and the secret, and I kept saying, wait a minute. If thoughts are so powerful, why are we manifesting parking spaces? Why don't we cure cancer with our thoughts? And is that as powerful as they could be, or are we just talking about shifting a quantum particle? And also, what happens when lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? Does it magnify the effect? And so that question led me to set up essentially the biggest test of it in the world, which was a thing called the Intention Experiment. In 2007, with the launch of that book by the same name, I set up an international experiment. And every so often, I would involve one of the scientists I knew who was from the University of Arizona or University of California or Russian physicists and Penn State University, many credible universities, to set up a controlled study. And then I would invite my readers around the world or an actual audience, if I was speaking somewhere, to send a well-controlled thought to that target. And then we would measure the effect. So we've run 30 of them so far, and 26 have shown measurable, positive, mostly significant effects. That's how I kind of segued into this. But everything I discovered about the power of intention actually got turned on its head doing these experiments and then working with smaller groups.
Let me ask you, which probably seems like the most basic question to you, but what is a human energy field? Because I think some of this is so hard for many people to grasp, because we know about meditation, we know about prayer, and here we're talking about our thoughts being able to have a much bigger impact than we could ever imagine. And how is that happening? What's the science behind a human energy field?
Well, I don't think there are individual human energy fields per se. That was one discovery I made with my book, The Field. What we're talking about is one giant underlying quantum field, which I called The Field. It's called in science the zero point field. And it is the field that unites us all like an invisible web. We're all part of it at our subatomic level. And subatomic particles actually aren't particles at all. They're vibrating packets of energy that exchange energy with other packets of energy like an ongoing, endless game of tennis. And this ongoing exchange between all the subatomic particles creates, you know, this unfathomable amount of energy and empty space. And that essentially is the field of which we're part. And because subatomic particles are also waves, what this all implies is that we're all connected. Now, in terms of how thoughts can affect things, the current thinking is that this giant field is also consciousness and that we tap into this. This is what we tap into when we have a thought. There's also evidence that there's a tiny current of light, a very, very coherent, organized light coming out of the body at all times, and that thought may be one other part of that light. But there is one thing we know for sure from the evidence, which is thoughts are trespassers. There's no question that they don't just get locked inside our brain, but they trespass other things and other people.
What do physicists say about this?
The scientists talk about us, perhaps consciousness is this field. What they can measure is the zero point field. That's definitely been measured. This whole teeming energy that's in empty space that surrounds us and of which we're part. They've been able to measure that. They've been able to measure light coming out of the body and light communicating within the body. They know that. They have evidence for all of that. They have evidence that thoughts create an effect on other people, on other things. We have loads of evidence for that. What they're not sure about is, are we just tapping into this consciousness or are we beaming out light?
You mean, do we have control over it? How much control?
Oh, no, no. We have control over it. That's okay. Clear. But what they're not quite sure about is the mechanism. There is a lot of evidence for this light changing and changing other things when we send a directed thought. There are a lot of ideas about it, but we may not know exactly what the mechanism is, but we can definitely prove and demonstrate, and I have in my experiments, but so have other scientists, that thoughts affect other things.
So what do people need to believe and do at the most basic level to make this real for them? Like just our listeners, for example, how can we use this idea to make our lives better, to create more peace in the world, as an example?
Well, I think just starting with making your life better, I mean, what my book is all about isn't just these big intention experiments. They're about what I discovered by accident. When I put people in groups of eight in my first workshop in 2008, I wanted to play around with the power of intention, but I wasn't really sure what to do. So I just thought, well, I'll put people in groups of eight or so and have them send an healing intention to someone in the group with a health challenge. I put these people into groups of eight. I told them to all hold the same healing intention for some member of the group with a health challenge. So let's say Jane Doe had pain in her right hip. So the healing intention would be, our intention is that Jane Doe be free of all pain in her right hip and be healthy and well in every way. So that everybody was told to hold that same thought in their heads while they imagined Jane Doe being healthy and well in every way. And I had them all visualize Jane Doe being better and making it up as I go along. You know, I honestly didn't have any evidence about this. So then the next day I invite them back, it's the second day of the workshop, to explain what happened and have the recipients talk about how they're feeling now. And I assume they'd say, oh, I'm feeling very relaxed, you know, kind of like a little meditation. But no, they stood up and they said things like, I've had terrible arthritis in my knees and it's gone. I had IBS for as long as I can remember, and my stomach and my gut feel normal now. And on, this went for about an hour. So I was shocked.
What was the scientist in you thinking about this? Because if this is true, then the healing potential is enormous. So I'm just so curious what that scientist and you thought about that.
Okay. Well, remember, I'm a science writer, not a scientist, but there is an inner scientist always in me.
Yeah. I'm referring to the inner scientist in you.
Yeah. Now, the inner scientist in me basically was horrified by this. I am very evidence-based. I never claimed to be a healer. I wanted to prove the power of intention with these serious intention experiments. So I thought this was going to undermine my serious work. I thought that I wouldn't be taken seriously. And I thought it was just way too woo-woo. And that wasn't what I am all about. So I didn't talk about it much, but I kept doing it, essentially to try to figure out what was going on. Mm-hmm. And in every workshop I ran, in every country I ran it in, we had these same amazing healings.
This is so hard to wrap our heads around, don't you?
Totally. No, and me harder than anybody else, which is why this first started in 2008. It's taken all this time for me to have the nerve to write about this because I needed to understand. I mean, there were all these amazing healings that continued to go on, and I buried this. I kept trying to go back to my big intention experiments, but I kept finding not only these healings, but also rebound effects in both the big experiments and the Power of Eight groups, where it wasn't just the receivers getting these healings, but also the senders were having amazing things happen to them in their lives.
Yeah. Well, have you brought this to the medical community, for example? Have you included doctors in some of the healings just to kind of get their response to it?
First of all, I've run a newsletter for 27 years called What Doctors Don't Tell You. And I've seen all kinds of exciting alternative remedies to take care of so many diseases out there. Mm-hmm. And I've also witnessed the complete blindness of a good deal of the orthodox medical profession to this. This is on the outer scale. What I am doing is going directly to the patients. I want to take this directly to people. I'm not going to wait for the approval of the medical profession because I could wait forever.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
So what about people who spend a lot of time praying for something to happen? Is that very different from the sort of directed intention setting that you're doing with the Power of Eight?
Well, the big difference we're doing is we're putting people in a group. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an individual doing this. And the interesting thing is what happens to the group. As I say, the biggest doubting Thomas about this, I had to try to find out what was going on. And so we actually did a study of the brainwaves of people in a Power of Eight group. I teamed up with the largest chiropractic university, and their president was intrigued by Power of Eight, and he invited me to make use of their psychology department. So we've begun a series of formal scientific studies. In the first one, we worked with a neuroscientist who put in QEEG cap to measure the brain waves of people in these Power of Eight groups. And they found there was a big global quieting of the parts of the brain that separate us out from everybody else and the rest of the universe. That was turned way down. So was the part of the brain that governs negativity, doubt, worry, that kind of thing. That was turned way down too. These people were in a state, according to their brainwaves, of ecstatic unity, ecstatic oneness. And what was really interesting is the brainwave signatures absolutely were virtually identical to those recorded by Dr. Andrew Newberg of the University of Pennsylvania, who has studied ecstatic states among Sufi masters, Buddhist monks, nuns in the midst of ecstatic prayer. He finds exactly the same signatures. And here's the real interesting part of it. The people who do that sort of thing usually require years of practice and disciplined study to get to that state. And then if they're trying to get to the state, they need hours of priming to get into that state. The people who were part of this study, most of them had never even meditated before. They'd certainly never done a Power of Eight group. They were total novices, enlisted from the student body. And yet, all they had from me was a 15-minute video telling them how to do it. And they were essentially almost instantly transported into this mystical state.
Can you describe a little more what this mystical or ecstatic state is versus, let's say, enlightenment or transcending in different, you know, sort of meditation types that people do?
Well, meditation has a very different brainwave signature that I also compared. It's a calming type of state. This was an energizing state, but it's a state of otherness, of complete otherness, of subsuming into a state of oneness. I'll explain it this way. First of all, this was the same experience that many of the people I surveyed doing the large intention experiments, particularly intention experiments for peace or healing of someone. And I just surveyed them to find out how it was for them, a routine survey. And I got back thousands of people saying things like this. I felt I was wired up to a higher network. I felt like I was the tractor beam in the midst of Star Trek. I had goosebumps up and down my arms. I connected so with the target, I could see this vision and that vision, and on and on and on. What they described in terms of an altered state had every similarity to what, say, Abraham Maslow describes as peak states. There is big physical changes. There is a sense of connection to the other people and the target. There is a sense of global oneness that takes them over. There is a kind of blinding epiphany of meaning. Everything begins to make sense to them. I feel better than I ever have before. That painful left leg doesn't hurt anymore. They've reconnected with their lives. And that's what Maslow talks about. And the people in both the large and small groups describe absolutely identical types of things. That is a classic enlightened state, and that's what they were experiencing.
It almost sounds like some states that people get into when they're using different types of recreational drugs, and you're tapping into that without that drug state. But if you can tap into it with drugs, I guess the question would be, why can't you tap into that state with other non-drug activities?
That's exactly it. I mean, here's the interesting part about this, because we think when we're going to try to enter a mystical state or altered state, we think we need a sweat lodge or ayahuasca or years and years of disciplined practice, but you don't. You don't need any of that.
Lynn, in one of your blogs, I read this quote, which says, "In time, mindfulness meditation will also heighten your visual perceptions and prevent you from becoming numb to your everyday experience." I'm curious about your thoughts on that, and also how a mindfulness or meditation practice really helps to enhance the intention setting process.
I teach people about extreme focus. One thing we discover, and this is true in a lot of the science, is that focused intention isn't a state of quiet. You know, we always think of it as being a little quiet meditative state. It may start from there. We start with some deep breathing, just a bit of deep breathing. But then I ask people to go into a focused state. And what that does, in order to achieve that, I suggest that people practice some mindfulness. Practice going into your senses and just feel what the moment looks like, sounds like, smells like, tastes like, feels like. And ultimately, they're going to use that when they're imagining someone being healthy and well. They're going to use all of their five senses to visualize that person as being well. So in that sense, we use a kind of mindfulness to get people into that kind of extreme focus.
Could I use my meditation or mindfulness practice to have some of these same impacts?
No. Looking at the brainwave studies for meditation is a very different thing. I mean, people have insights during meditation, of course. They're all wonderful. But it's about having the other there all the time. And here's a big piece of it. One of the biggest pieces of it is altruism. I was, again, totally skeptical about this. So I said, okay, ultimate test. I'm going to invite people to be part of a year-long experiment with me. And I invited people to be part of a master class in 2015, and 250 people signed up. And I taught them over 7 weeks on teleseminar. And then I put them into groups of eight and had them meet every week. And I observed them and monitored them every month to find out what was going on in their health, their relationships, their career, and their life's purpose, and generally. And of the 250 people, about 150 met regularly with their group. And of that 150, pretty much 100% had some sort of major transformation. One woman reversed her chronic fatigue of 15 years. Another guy reversed what was lifelong depression, and very frustrating for him because he was a clinical psychologist with it. And he'd tried every integrative thing in the book. A lot of physical healings, but also people who got their dream jobs. We had a lot of people leaving their jobs and setting up something they'd always wanted to do, some sort of enterprise, and it going really well. Amazing changes for just about everybody. But here's the piece that I wanted to emphasize. There's an altruistic component here that works as a virtuous circle. And that's why we're not talking about individual practice. We're talking about a small group practice and why it's so powerful. I started looking into the science of altruism. And it was really fascinating to me because, for instance, there was a study on prayer. It was a psychologist and he was also a priest. He wanted to see if prayer would actually work for mental illness, not just physical illness. So he got 400 plus volunteers who were all people suffering from depression. And he divided them into two groups. One group was the people who were going to get prayer, and the other group were going to be the people who were going to do the praying. And so he had them go through this, and afterward he measured how they were doing on, you know, some sort of specific professional scale. And he found that the people who had got prayer were doing better, definitely better. But the people who had done the praying for them were doing better still. They were really in good shape. And he had to conclude that doing the praying, doing the giving was better than doing the receiving. And that occurs over and over again in all of the science of altruism, because I felt this was a piece of the whole thing and why we're having these effects. If you look at the science of altruism, whatever it is, no matter how much you give, just giving something, the people who do that live longer, they're happier. Mm. And it's that being part of something bigger that I think is one big key element to the power of this.
We all talk about the power of connection and the power of community, and it sounds like that's really at the heart of all of this, tapping into that zero point field or that quantum field with a group energy, and that deep belief seems to be the power here.
I think that's right. I think there's a number of things. There's the altruism, there's the group, there's the intention and the kind of effect of group intention. There's the brainwave entrainment. There's the altered state. And then maybe there's another X factor. But I think, yes, the power of connection, we are just beginning to understand how important, how essential this is, how mysterious and transformational it is. But here was a study that really talked to me. Two studies. One was comparing people who live the good life, who are seeking pleasure and enjoyment out of life, what we'd consider the American dream, an affluent life and lots of holidays, all of that. And then they compared them to people who are living maybe less affluent life, but a life of meaning. And they found that the people who were focused on themselves and a life of pleasure, et cetera, had terrible immune system markers. These guys were candidates for heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, all the degenerative diseases. The other group, however, had unbelievably robust immune systems. So that started speaking to me about some of the dangers we have with the whole idea of the self-help movement. I mean, it's done many good things. It's all about a focus on the self. All I can conclude with the work that I'm doing is when you focus on the other, it has far more powerful effects in healing you. So we've always heard that line, do unto others. You know, it's like a Hallmark card now. But maybe it should be think unto others, because that seems to be one of the key elements that's so powerful is this mirror effect, this rebound effect.
How has this work changed your life personally?
And I was shocked by this for such a long time. And then I started apologizing for it, saying when I'd run these workshops, I'd say, well, I don't understand what this is. I'm learning with you. And it wasn't until I saw some of the brainwave changes and some of the other evidence that I finally amassed about it that I started believing maybe this is true when it came to the big experiments or even the little Power of Eight groups. And I'd always say, oh, well, short answer, who knows, you know, lots of variables, blah, 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 blah. And now I just say, who cares? Mm. Because what's really important is you can't really reduce this down to the workings of brainwaves or, say, the vagus nerve, which gets turned on when we do something altruistic, and it turns on all the caring portions of our body that also helps rejuvenate the immune system. So that's another reason why you do something altruistic, and it works like a virtuous circle on you to keep you getting healthier and healthier. But there's something beyond that. I don't ask these questions so much anymore, I guess. I think I've become what I like to call a reluctant apostle of the amazing transformational power of small groups.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to share with us?
I really want to emphasize how easy it is to do this. I have full instructions in my book, The Power of Eight, for setting up your own group.
Thank you so much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you, Patricia. It's been really exciting to be here and to share it. And I do really want to emphasize with people that try it. If you don't believe it, just try it and see what happens. And you'll become, like me, you'll become a believer.
Skeptic believers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Lynn for being on our show today. For information on her work, go to lynnmctaggart.com. She has materials there on how you can start your own intention group. If you enjoyed this podcast, can you take a minute to rate and review it? And any feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store or on Google Play. We'll see you next time.